State of opportunity.
State of opportunity.
I want to be a firefighter.
A ballerina.
I want to be a Batman.
This is a State of Opportunity documentary from Michigan Radio. I'm Dustin Dwyer. Today, The Hidden Epidemic, Part 2. On October 27th, 1986, President Reagan signed a new law to fight drug use in America. Buried within that law were new penalties for those convicted of selling drugs. The premise behind those penalties was to get the most serious drug offenders off the streets and send a message that dealing drugs in America is a crime that does not pay. Eugene Atkins never got that message.
One thing about Gene always was above everybody else. He always grew up a little faster than the rest of us. I'm Joseph Russall, and I'm definitely a childhood friend of Gene's. We both grew up in the same neighborhood, the wealthy area, wealthy Fuller area, Sigsby.
This is the area teenagers from the suburb of Granville started coming to in the fall of 2004 to get their heroin fix. Many of them arrived here already addicted. And for a few months, until he was caught, Eugene Atkins was the dealer who helped them feed that addiction. Rousseau says this was a tough place to grow up, but it was also tight-knit.
Everybody knew everybody, like Cheers, man. Everybody knew everybody's name and where they came from. Everybody knew everyone's parents at that time.
Yeah, everyone's happy. All the neighborhood kids, seemed like they were brothers and sisters. They did everything together. They went to school together. On the weekends, they'd all be in the park early in the morning with their pajamas on, playing in the park.
This is Felicia Sims. She's Eugene's mom. She told me Eugene was a good kid. He loved animals. He was a class clown. He liked cars. When he was a teenager, he held down a job working in the cafeteria of a hospital. It made him some money. But his mom noticed he bought some things that he shouldn't have been able to afford. And she knew where that extra money was coming from. She tried to get him to stop.
Sometimes he would kind of stay away because, you know, I'd get on him all the time. But, yeah, just, you know, sometimes kids think they know better than their parents do.
Everybody did it around here. Everybody sold something once upon in their life. They childhood, if you were out here at that time, you sold something. You at least tried to. You tried it.
Okay, y'all can talk. I'm just...
All right. Eugene, you can hear me okay?
Yeah, I can hear you.
To talk to Eugene Atkins, I had to set up a three-way call through his sister, Tanisha. Eugene still talks to his family a couple times a week when his prison isn't on lockdown.
Tell me how things are going there. Where are you right now, and how is it?
I'm at USP Hazleton, and it ain't good at all.
Hazleton's a federal penitentiary in the mountains of West Virginia, a 500-mile drive from where Eugene grew up. Hazleton gets some of the most violent criminals in America and in the world. One of Hazleton's most famous inmates is a drug kingpin connected to the Cali drug cartel in Colombia. Joaquin Valencia Trujillo was accused of running a multi-billion dollar drug operation, sending 100 tons of cocaine into the United States every year for about a decade. And right there in the same prison is Eugene Atkins, a street-level dealer from Grand Rapids, picked up when he was 19 years old for selling packets of heroin to other teenagers. The difference at Hazleton between Atkins and the cartel kingpin is the kingpin is scheduled to be released at some point. Atkins is serving life without parole. You're listening to State of Opportunity from Michigan Radio. I'm Dustin Dwyer. Today, the story of how Michigan failed to respond to one of the worst epidemics in its history, the epidemic of opiate drug abuse. And we're trying to understand it right now through the story of one of the earliest overdose deaths that happened during this epidemic, when 17-year-old Matthew McKinney of Granville died on December 15, 2004. After Matt died, his mother, Mary DeBoer, told me she tried to get others to pay attention to help make sure no other parents had to feel the pain she felt. She talked to whoever she could about it, school leaders, doctors, addiction experts. But really, only one organization ever listened to her, the U.S. Attorney's Office. After an investigation from local police, the federal prosecutor's office in Grand Rapids quickly zeroed in on who might have been responsible for Matt's death. The person they went after is Eugene Atkins. Atkins admits he was a heroin dealer. He first started selling drugs when he was in the eighth grade. People would come up to him and ask him if they could buy drugs.
Because, I mean, when you're around it all day and you pretty much ain't got nothing to do or nothing in your pockets, and somebody would walk up to you and ask you for something, and you could have easily made a couple dollars. I mean, it's that easy, so you're going to figure out how you can not miss out on a couple dollars next time.
Yeah.
You don't really think about no consequences, nothing like that.
Yeah.
Atkins started selling weed. He moved on to cocaine. Then he got busted the first time. By that time, he should have known. Everyone told him to stop dealing. His closest friends, his mom. And the laws don't look kindly on second-time drug offenders. Eugene knew that. He was still a teenager. But he knew that. But, as Gene tells the story now, that first stint in prison is actually why he became a heroin dealer.
It's a funny story because I seen a movie and then somebody approached me while I was locked up, and we was talking. You know, when you were locked up, a lot of people tell stories. So people was telling stories about drugs they use and all that stuff. When I got out, I bumped into this particular person, and I really hadn't learned nothing about it. Still to this day, I really don't know too much about it. I just knew how to get it and who to sell it to, who wanted it.
What Atkins didn't know back then is that switching from dealing cocaine to dealing heroin isn't just a business decision. Heroin is a much more dangerous drug. It's more addictive than other drugs. It kills far more people. Matthew McKinney was not a heavy heroin user. It's possible he only tried the drug a few times. On December 14, 2004, he snuck out of his parents' house, hopped in the car with his friend Chris Perrin, and they went to get high. Call records on Perrin's phone would show a number of calls to Eugene Atkins that night. Perrin would later testify in court that Matt shot up around 10 p.m., right before getting a call from his mother, reminding them that his curfew was up. Matt told his mother he'd be home soon. Minutes later, he was passed out, his sleeve still rolled up. Chris Perrin kept driving. He stopped at Meyer, flirted with a girl inside. He drove to his mom's house to call his aunt for her birthday. He had a long argument with his girlfriend and talked it over with his mom. And the entire time, Matthew McKinney was passed out in the car. He had no coat. It was 19 degrees outside that night. Perrin would say he checked on Matt a few times. He heard Matt snoring, a sign of a person struggling to breathe during an overdose. At one point, Chris tried to move his friend to get him inside, but he said Matt was too heavy. Sometime around 2:30 a.m., Perrin and his mother went down to the parked car and put blankets over Matt. Less than 5 hours later, Matt was found dead.
We initially entered into an agreement with Eugene Atkins to have him cooperate against Chris Perrin, who was with Matt McKinney at the time and who was originally interviewed by law enforcement and was not truthful with law enforcement.
Ray Beckering is assistant U.S. attorney for the Western District of Michigan. He was the attorney who prosecuted Eugene Atkins.
And it was always our intention to prosecute Chris Perrin to the full extent of the law and to actually cut our deal first and foremost with Eugene Atkins and prosecute Chris Perrin for his culpability as well.
Beckering says Perrin could have been charged for lying. He actually was charged for lying, but he only served 2 years for it. And as for the rest, it's not exactly illegal to leave an unconscious person in a freezing cold car all night. But there is a special section in the 1986 Anti-Drug Abuse Act that outlines the penalties for anyone convicted of selling drugs that result in serious injury or death. The minimum sentence is 20 years in prison. But if you have a prior conviction for selling drugs, like Eugene Atkins did, the minimum sentence is life in prison. The U.S. Attorney's Office offered Atkins a deal that would have avoided that mandatory life sentence. Eugene Atkins took that deal and pled guilty at first.
And I really pretty much took it out of fear because my lawyer kept telling me, you're going to spend the rest of your life in prison. You're going to go in there in front of that jury. Most of them is going to be white people that don't understand and they ain't even going to be trying to really decipher the facts. And they're going to convict you, and then you're going to spend the rest of your life in prison.
Atkins knew he was guilty of selling heroin, but he didn't believe he was the one who sold the heroin that killed Matt McKinney. He still doesn't believe it. And he says the more he thought about that plea deal, the worse he felt about it. So he took it back. He wrote a letter to the judge in the case. He begged that his guilty plea be tossed out. He asked for a new lawyer and a trial. He did this because he believed, and he still believes, that even though he dealt heroin regularly to kids in Granville, he wasn't the one who dealt the heroin that killed Matt McKinney.
Yeah. He said our other friend sold it to him. From day one he said that, y'all.
This is Joe Russo again. He's one of Gene's closest friends. He's also friends with the other person, the person who frequently sold heroin alongside Gene. Russo told me the story around the neighborhood was that this other friend is the one who actually dealt the drugs the night Matt McKinney died. And this friend's name came up at Eugene's trial. Now, I'm only going to use his first name here because I haven't found any hard evidence to suggest he had anything to do with the death of Matthew McKinney. But this friend's name is Ryan. And after Eugene Atkins went to prison, Joe Russo says he and other friends from the neighborhood talked to Ryan about his role in the case a lot. It weighed on Ryan.
He got depressed over it. He was messed up a little bit.
Because you think he knew?
Well, yes. It was a lot of people putting pressure on him to do that, and he wasn't going for it.
Because he said that he didn't do it?
No, because he didn't want to go to jail. He thought he was going to go to jail for it. And he seen the charges Gene was facing. He was scared. He was like, no, he wasn't going for it.
So hang on. Does Ryan say to you that he was the one who gave drugs to that kid that night?
Well,
what's the story you've heard? I know you weren't there, but what's the story you heard?
Yeah, nah, I really don't want to get all into that one. I really don't. That's deep.
Tell me why you don't want to get into. You don't have to tell me like what the thing is, but like what's after all these years? You believe your friend Gene?
Yeah.
You believe your friend Gene didn't give those drugs that killed that kid?
You gotta remember. These are people I love, and a lot of things with it. It's some things is just not to be told. It's just you need to get the information from that person. I'd rather them tell it than I tell it. It's that serious, you know.
The people investigating the death of Matthew McKinney never interviewed Ryan. They never collected his phone records to see where he was the night Matt died. I sent a letter to Ryan in June asking if he'd talk with me. He's in state prison now, serving a sentence for assault. I never heard back from Ryan. I asked Ray Beckering, the prosecutor, about this side of the story. He told me investigators had the phone records for Eugene, for Matt, and for Matt's friend, Chris Perrin, from that night. There were no calls to Ryan, only Eugene. So to the idea that Eugene Atkins wasn't responsible for Matt McKinney's death...
All I could say is that the phone records established differently, the witnesses, eyewitnesses established differently, and the jury certainly found differently.
When the jury found Eugene Atkins guilty of dealing the heroin that killed Matt McKinney, Matt's mom, Mary DeBoer, felt, for a little while, a small sense of relief. The verdict came more than a year after her son's death. And since then, she'd been trying everything she could to get people to pay attention to the problem of drug addiction in Granville. And here, finally, was something she could say that had been done about it.
It was a relief that there was justice and that Matt got justice and that this kid wouldn't be on the streets hurting anybody else anymore. But at the same time, it was very painful because, you know, I look across the courtroom and here's this mom who's also losing her son now.
It was hard because I could feel her pain, but in this, at the same time, you know, I'm feeling like, you know, I'm losing my son too because he's finna go. But I mean, if he did it, fine, you know, because I've always taught my kids right from wrong. Because I was like, if he did it and he had to be convicted of it, fine, but he didn't do it. So don't take my kid for something he didn't do.
Mary DeBoer still believes the evidence against Eugene Atkins. She believes he's responsible for her son's death. When I told her Gene's side of things, more than anything, she seemed hurt that he hasn't admitted it yet. Still, the way she felt years ago, she doesn't feel that way anymore. She no longer thinks Eugene Atkins should spend the rest of his life in prison.
I would like to give his mom a chance to have her son back for a little bit. I really would.
You think so? Do you think that's possible?
I don't know.
There was one other person who could say for sure what happened that night. Chris Perrin. He was the one who drove the car to go buy the drugs. He was with Matt when Matt used the drugs. He's the one who left Matt in the car in the cold for hours while Matt overdosed. Chris Perrin was the main witness in the trial against Eugene Atkins. But Chris can't tell us anything now about what happened that night in 2004. Chris died just a few months ago. His family told me it was a heroin overdose.
He would have nightmares.
This is Chris's former girlfriend, Amanda.
And he'd wake up, like, either crying or sweating or just somehow bothered by it in whatever way, and tell me that, you know, he had a dream about Matt, and then he wouldn't really want to elaborate on it any further. But it happened a lot.
Amanda isn't just an old girlfriend. She's the mother of two of Chris's three kids. We sat in the shade at Heritage Park in Granville while the kids played on the playground. Amanda told me Chris loved Matt, and it weighed on Chris that nearly everyone he knew blamed him for the death of his friend, that he blamed himself for not doing more to help Matt, and that he never overcame his own addiction.
I always will, and I always have, felt like Chris is my soulmate. Even through everything that, all the pain that he caused me, and all the hurt and all that stuff. He had a heart of gold. He was an amazing person when he was sober, but his demons were bigger than he was, and his addiction took his life. Took him away from his kids, took him away from us, and it just consumed him.
Of the kids in Granville who started using heroin around 2004, at least four are now dead. Others tell me the number's much higher. And many are still battling their addiction. No one's addiction ended when Eugene Atkins went to prison.
Did you ever feel like there was something that could have helped him, that something that someone just didn't try, or some treatment he didn't get, that what, you know, was there anything that you felt like someone could have done?
I feel like if it would have been dealt with when he was younger, it would have been a totally different story. And I don't even mean that by him being younger. If it would have been dealt with better at the beginning of his addiction rather than just being brushed underneath the rug all the time. But that's just something that I've encountered with all heroin addicts that I've dealt with, that if their families didn't just try to brush it under the rug, or people that they loved, or even prisons or rehab facilities, if they just didn't... Yeah, schools, everything. If they didn't just brush this stuff underneath the rug and they talked about it and they put it out there.
That hasn't been the approach now for at least a decade. The opiate epidemic that's taken the lives of Chris Perrin, Matt McKinney, and thousands of others in Michigan has been dealt with as a criminal issue when it's been dealt with at all. That approach wasn't enough to stop the problem. But more than a decade into this crisis, some people are ready to try something new.
We're at that epidemic level where innovation is going to lead us out of this.
We'll hear about new approaches to the problem in Michigan and beyond tomorrow. You're listening to State of Opportunity from Michigan Radio.
Support for State of Opportunity comes from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, a partner with communities where children come first.